I can't guarantee how inspirational I'll be, but I know I'm perspirational. I could have worn my ABK sweatshirt. I wouldn't have had to dress up. Okay, this is a doozy. The promise of pain. I fell February 24th, and you should count the stairs when you go down the stairs, because when you don't, then you fall. and I severely sprained both ankles, so this is why this chair is here, and just in case I need to, actually, maybe I'll just take advantage of that. I'll just have a seat here. So coming up with, I was trying to think of what promise of God can we do, and there's so many promises, and I always try to look for new and unique things, and it just kind of dawned on me, pain. Huh, you know what? God promises pain. So this delved into a big thing. And when I'm asked to speak anywhere, it's not a light thing. Like, this is 6 months. When I go home, I'm probably going to sleep. this is like studying for university. And like every moment, if you're not, you know, if I'm going to watch TV tonight, oh, you shouldn't watch TV tonight. You should probably be studying. There's quite a few books that the thought process going into all this, I can't take credit for all of it. So I did read The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis, Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis, Philip Yancey, Where is God When It Hurts? Another book by Philip Yancey and Paul Brand is The Gift of Pain, Why We Hurt and What We Can Do About It. Ellen Vaughn, Becoming Elizabeth Elliot. And then she has another book that was an audiobook that I listened to that was Being Elizabeth Elliot. So all of those is in 5 pages of notes that I have to get through in 20 minutes. So when we look through, here's a few verses that when you look through the Bible, there are, like, there's a ton of promises, which you've already gone through quite a few of them in coffee hour. So I'm going to read you a few verses, and all of these have something in common. 2 Corinthians 4, 16 to 18. Therefore, we do not lose heart, for outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far awaits them all. James 1, 2 to 4. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, when you fall into various trials, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. John 16, 33. I have told you these things that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world. Romans 5, 3 to 5. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, tribulations, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, character, hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured out in our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. So what do all of those things have in them? Pain, trouble, suffering. So a good conclusion is that our lives are going to be full of happiness. So how is pain a gift? Why is that a promise? Well, let's imagine a world without it. Dr. Paul Brand, he was a British surgeon from 1914 to 2003. He was a world-renowned orthopedic specialist and a leprosy surgeon. See, he was one of the world's foremost experts in leprosy. So he was the son of missionary parents in Southwest India. He went to medical school in London, University, England. He became an orthopedic surgeon. He met his wife there. She also was in medical school. In 1946, they returned to India, and they saw a lot of deformities caused by leprosy. And little was known at that time about what the true cause of leprosy was. Most people thought that it was the leprosy disease itself caused the deformity, caused the flesh skin to rot. So one of his colleagues said, I think you should really do some investigation into this and find out exactly why. So it was him, Paul Brand, who pioneered the idea that the loss of the fingers and toes was entirely due to infection, not the leprosy. So what leprosy does is it attacks the nerves, and it usually attacks the nerves in your coldest regions of your body, your nose, your eyes, your hands, things that are really close to the surface. So once he figured that out, it was like, okay, it's the nerves that are causing the patient to have no pain. The pain then causes you to hurt yourself. When you hurt yourself, then you don't respond. You hit yourself, and you repeatedly hit yourself, and it never has a chance to heal because you're repeatedly hitting yourself. Leprosy isn't the only condition that this causes. Diabetes can also cause nerve damage, which leads to not as much pain. There's something that's called congenital insensitivity to pain, CIP. It's very rare, but children who are born with it, they will often scratch their faces, they'll scratch their eyes. Some will become blind. They just scratch their eyes out. One child bit the tips of her fingers off when she was teething because she didn't know. This child chewed on her tongue and her lips so often, caused so many infections and damage that her parents opted to remove all of her baby teeth. Another child was so destructive that by the age of 11, she was living in an institution. She refused to wear proper shoes, so she had damage to her feet, and then because she didn't limp on those damaged feet, she caused huge deformities to her joints, and she eventually lost both of her legs. She lost most of her fingers, her elbows were constantly dislocated, her tongue was badly scarred and lacerated because she had a nervous habit of chewing on it. Often, young people who have this condition will die at an early age because they do something foolish. One boy jumped off a roof. Pain is what teaches you that something is wrong, and it causes a response. Yancey says that pain is as essential to normal life. It could be argued as eyesight or even good circulation. Without pain, our lives would be fraught with danger and devoid of many of the basic pleasures. So pain is the gift nobody wants. One of the mothers, the only gift that she wanted to give her child was pain. And you think, what an evil gift. But that's the only thing that would save her child. God designed pain to keep me alive and healthy. And yet billions of dollars go towards eliminating pain. What I think is a bad thing, you know, my ankles hurt, that's a bad thing, God has given as a good thing. So what I sometimes might think is good, God might think is bad. So I must conclude then that my judgment differs from God. Our judgment differs from God. Why? Because he's wiser than you. That's an easy one. That's an easy one. Crucial point. God is wiser than you. Things happen that we don't understand, that we'll never understand. We aren't God. We haven't seen eternity past. He sees the future, he sees the present, and somehow in his brain, he can fit that all together. Can you? I can't. But we blame God for everything that we perceive, in my judgment, as negative. I could do without fear. I'd be happy to not be afraid. Yancey says that fear, like pain, serves as a warning system, only with the added benefit of functioning in advance of harm. So you fear falling because the last time you fell down the stairs, you sprained both ankles. But the guy who jumped off the roof, when he was young, he jumped down the stairs and broke his ankle. But because he didn't feel that pain, he had no fear. There was nothing experience that he had that would tell him that that was a bad idea. Fear, the physiology behind fear, is that it uses minute quantities of adrenaline to speed up your heart rate, increase your skin friction, heighten your reaction time, and give you an added bit of strength. So you see a car coming, and sometimes you have superhuman strength to get out of the way of the car, right? You might not be a fast runner, but a car coming after you, you're going to run because you have fear. That fear is what strives you. What would we be like without that fear? It's God's given. What about guilt? How many of you feel guilty and you think, oh, I wasn't sure I was guilty. The U.S. court system says, defines sanity as the ability to discern between good and evil. And a world with no guilt would tilt toward insanity. So guilt is what gives us a curb in our behavior. If you had nothing guilty, man, we'd be like full of psychopaths. So guilt is a pain message to our conscience. Guilt is says, like, you know, if I hit my thumb on a tack, that's the pain to make me pull. But guilt is the same to my conscience to say, something's not right. It's not worth it for me to go and steal your cookie because I'm going to feel guilty about that, and I don't want that on my soul. So it's something informing us, our conscience, that something is wrong and you need to do something about it. So then thinking more and more, then why did God have to use something like pain, something that was unpleasant? Why unpleasant? Why couldn't it have been something like a breeze across my face? Dr. Brand, let's go back to the leprosy, was given a $7 million grant for the express purpose of designing an artificial pain system for his leprosy patients. And so he thought, okay, let's concentrate first on the fingers. A simple substitute that could alert those people with no pain that, hey, there's pain, stop doing what you're doing so that you don't damage yourself. So they started with the fingertips, but they had so many complications. So how could something like the pressure that I need to pick up this piece of paper, how do you adjust it if I'm picking up a thorn bush or a thorn bush comes along? How do you adjust that? Or if I hurt my finger, do you know that your body, an inflamed body part, is 10 times more sensitive than normal? And the reason for that is that so that you stop. That's your body's response of saying, stop doing this. Hop on your foot. Hop on your other foot. stop doing what you're doing. Well, how could they make that? Each artificial sensor cost $450. This was back in the 70s and late 60s. But they always broke down. After a few hundred uses, the sensors would break. And the human body has several hundred million sensors. So how can you use that? So they tried first to create pain without hurting the patient. So they would do a sound, a hum or something like that. But the patients, it was too easy to ignore. Your backup camera. How many of you just totally ignore your backup camera because it's wah, wah, wah? It's annoying. You turn it off. Your alarm clock. You turn your alarm clock off, but that's the whole reason, because it's annoying. You would have to put it away somewhere. Then they tried blinking lights, but the same thing. They would just ignore the blinking lights. Then they thought, okay, let's put an electric shock somewhere on the body part that was still sensitive, but then they would take it off. People had to be forced to respond. Being alerted to the danger wasn't enough. The stimulus had to be unpleasant, just as plain as unpleasant. The pain was what forced a response. Also, they had to have the signal that was outside of the patient's reach. Otherwise, they would just take it like your alarm clock, turn it off. It had to be somewhere far beyond. After 5 years of working, thousands of man hours and several millions of dollars, they had to abandon the entire project. And Dr. Paul Brand says, a system sometimes called God's great mistake was far too complex for even the most sophisticated technology to mimic. Now think of that pain then into your own life of trials and suffering. A loving God gave you pain. Are you convinced that's loving? Not when I'm the one in pain. I want a loving God that provides me with only the good things that meets my definition of love. C.S. Lewis says that what would really satisfy us would be a God who said of anything we happen to like doing, what does it matter so long as they are contented? We want, in fact, not so much a father in heaven, but a grandfather in heaven, a senile benevolence who, as they say, likes to see young people enjoying themselves and whose plan for the universe was simply that they might be truly said at the end of each day that a good time was had by all. Right? This is what we want. If you truly are truly truthful with yourself, that is what I want. Don't we all want to live in that kind of a universe? But it's abundantly clear when you look around us today that we don't. And I have reason to believe that God is a God of love. Therefore, my conception of love, just like my conception of good and pain, it's got to be different than God's. So in the context, one of the things, what is love? One aspect of love is that it demands the perfecting of the beloved. So how many moms have you heard say, ha, you didn't tie your shoe. Now you'll learn to tie your shoe. You fell. Why does she say that? Because she knows that the little hurt now of, oh, you tripped and you fell and you didn't tie your shoe, is going to maybe cause, like, you got to learn to tie your shoe. Otherwise, you know, you might fall and go down the stairs. We have 3 steps in our house. You go up the 3 steps and then you go down 10. Mom never put a baby gate up there because you got to learn if you fall down those 3 stairs, that's better than falling down the 10 stairs. Maybe I still need the baby gates. But she does that because she knows that she wants something better. She wants a certain characteristics out of her kid. So that tiny little pain now is fine, is acceptable than something further beyond. How many moms do you say, oh, my son, he's such a lovely man. He's 40 and he lies. He's such a liar and he's a thief, but he's happy. And that's all that matters is he's happy. Is that loving? No, that's not really loving. C.S. Lewis says that the problem of reconciling human suffering with the existence of a God who loves is impossible to solve when we attach trivial meaning to the word love. To ask that God's love should be content with us just as we are, not changing anything about me, is to ask that God should cease to be God. Because he already loves us, he must labor to make us lovable. Kindness tolerates anything except suffering. We don't want suffering. Therefore, we want God to be kind, but not loving. When we want to be something other than the thing that God wants for us, then we must be wanting what in fact will not make us happy. I rescued my dog from Attawapiskat. And she was being attacked by other dogs. It was this pathetic looking thing. I brought her into the house. She was smelly. She was stinky. She had bad manners. But there was something in her that I saw that I liked. So I thought it's worthwhile for me to bring her in. So when I brought her, I bathed her, I brushed her, I trimmed her nails, I taught her not to pounce on food, I taught her not to pull when walking, I taught her to come when called, I taught her not to steal things off of the food off the counters, not to jump on people, and where to go poop and pee. All of those things. In her natural state, she was smelly, and she had behaviors that weren't lovable. I took her and made her more lovable. Now, I don't know what happens in a dog's brain, but during this training process, I'm sure she contemplated my goodness. What are you doing? I like my nails this long. I like smelling this way. I don't want to smell like your shampoo. You know, all those things is I'm sure she's like, what is she doing? But she's now a more better trained dog. Her coat is beautiful. She's well behaved. My dad takes her to prayer meetings on Wednesday morning because she's so well behaved. And I introduced her to a whole different world outside of her previous existence. She's going to live much better than the other dogs in Attawapiskat, and she's got a much wider life, better life, than any of the other dogs in Attawapiskat, because I put training into her. Sometimes pain and suffering, being uncomfortable, is the only thing that will change us. And God loves us enough to allow suffering and pain, not because he delights in it, but because he's changing us. C.S. Lewis says that we wouldn't bother to house train an earwig or give bath to centipedes. We rather are a divine work of art, something that God is making, and therefore something with which he will not be satisfied until it has a certain character. We may wish, indeed, that we were of so little count to God that he left us alone to follow our natural impulses, that he would give us over to trying to train us into something so unlike our natural selves, right? I don't want all that training. I don't want that kind of love. But we would be asking, we wouldn't be asking for more love. We would be asking for less love. Yancey says that the source of human suffering and pain in our world, one point. God can and does work out pain and suffering for our good. But God isn't always directly responsible for pain and suffering. Yancey says that much of the suffering on our planet has come about because of two principles that God built into creation. One is a physical world that runs according to consistent laws, and the other is human freedom. So natural laws, planetary motion, the laws of chemistry, the laws of gravity, the laws of physics. He chose those so that we would have a logical, consistent, orderly universe. Our human freedom. I used to think, why wouldn't it be better if God just made it so that we couldn't sin? Well, if we couldn't sin, we couldn't, and we were programmed to do a certain thing, how is that loving? God made us for his own glory. How is a programmed human glorifying to God? When my dog does something nice, cute, whatever, she's doing it because it's her. It's her that did it. I didn't program her to do it. If I had one of those little child toys walking thing, that's not cute. That's programmed. Oh, look, it begged. It's programmed to do that. God didn't do that. He gave us complete freedom of choice to do with as we wanted to. And in order to be with freedom of choice, he had to put us into an environment that constituted being able to have a freedom of choice. So think of a prisoner in prison in a 4x4 cell that's very small, that has nothing in it. What freedom of choice does he have? He only has the freedom of choice that is limited by that amount of space, right? He's going to make only a certain set of choices because his environment is designed for that. But God didn't do that for us. God put us in this huge, beautiful world, in a perfect garden, and we chose to sin. Yancey says that by committing himself to those two principles, both good principles in themselves, God allowed for the possibility of their abuse. So, water. Water's a wonderful thing. You can't live without it. You can drink it. You can bathe in it. It's essential to life, but you can drown in it. Too much causes floods. Too little causes droughts. Wood. Wood, you can make wonderful good things, pianos out of wood. Trees that provide oxygen, shade. But you can fashion a club and you can hit somebody over the head with it. Gravity keeps you on the ground. Keeps you from floating away. If a person slips and falls, or decides to end their life and jump off a cliff, or another person decides to push them, should God reverse the natural laws of gravity and all of a sudden say, whoop, nope, you slipped and fell, done, now you're safe, I'm going to just ease you over to here. Or, oh, that guy's going to hit you with a club, let's turn that club into a sponge. Should he do those things? Should he change the consistent laws of gravity? If he did, he would cease to become God, because then he's not longer consistent. He's no longer causing those things. Now, miracles do happen, and we're not going to even get into the whole realm of miracles, because it's another whole realm, and I have 0.2 seconds left. But God can't be self-contradictory. That's an impossibility. He's given us free will to do with as we choose. We can choose to love him. We can choose to kill. We can choose to hate. He can't force us to do those things. But allow and cause are two different things. You allow your child to drive a car, right? You know that the potential is there for your child to drive the car and he may get into an accident. Does that mean you caused the accident because you knew it might happen? You give your child a bike. You know when he's learning to ride a bike, he probably is going to fall. Does that mean that you caused the accident? No, it doesn't mean you caused the accident. Allowing something and pushing the person over on the bike are two completely different things, right? We are so used to, in our world, knowing the answers to why. Why? The first thing you do is say, I wonder how this happens. And you say, go ask Google. All the information is at our fingertips. But it's not always so. God promises suffering. And he explicitly states, in this world you have trouble. He's telling us that there's going to be pressures. There's going to be trials. Does he delight in it? If he delighted in suffering, then why would so much of his ministry on earth have been healing people, easing their suffering? And ultimately, why would he have gone to the cross? So what do we do with the suffering? Job, when he was suffering, so many examples, he asked God why. 35 chapters of asking God why. And then, does God answer all of his questions? Not specifically. So what does he do? He takes him on a virtual tour of his grandness. And God says, who is this that darkens my counsel without words and without knowledge? Are you wise enough to run the world? Do you have an arm like God? And can your voice thunder like this? God hit Job with overwhelming power. And seeing that power, all of Job's questions just went, oh, okay. You are so much grander. Okay. God was in control and showed Job that God was in control. And he wanted a response from Job, and Job gave it to him of surrender. Yancey says that our search for meaning should move in a forward-looking direction toward the result of suffering rather than dwelling on its cause. When you continually dwell on the whys, answers that don't have questions, you can't ever move forward. And it doesn't just end there. God just didn't say, I am God. He said, I'm also going to show you my love. So if he was in heaven, saved us from heaven, never came down to earth, never experienced humanity, we could say, God, you just don't understand. But he didn't. He came down to earth. He experienced life on earth, and he felt it. Hebrews says that he felt every temptation known to man. And the physical suffering that Jesus endured was awful. But there have, in the world, been more people, have been other people, who have been tortured more than Jesus was tortured. But nobody had all the sins, past, present, and future, put on them. And then the one person who was in their corner turned their back on him and abandoned him. Why did he do that? Because all of a sudden, something that was perfectly pure was fully saturated with sin. And perfection and sin don't go together. And Jesus at the cross, you say, well, did he really? He was so, if you heard Andrew on Sunday, Jesus was in agony. He was so anxious about going to the cross that he asked Jesus, if there's any way, three times, if there's any way that you can have this cup removed from me, please let it be so. And he was so anxious that he sweat blood. Like, that's anxious. And then on the cross, he said, Father, why have you abandoned me? Why? He asked those questions. Do you think that he doesn't understand our suffering? No. He overwhelmed Job with his power, and now he's overwhelming us with his love. I get you. I understand you. And you know what? Because I've been through this, and because I know what it's like, I'm going to flood you with promises. Do you know there's thousands of promises in the Bible? There's all different kinds of promises. Some are for us, some are not for us. Some of the ones that you've already learned in coffee hour are, I will never leave you, forsake you, I am with you always. Fear not, I am with you, be strong and courageous. All of these, a lot of these promises, are things that Jesus would have felt while on earth. He's giving you a promise because he also knew what that was like. He also knew what anxiety was and loneliness was. Who better to give you comfort than the person who's also been through it? How many of you have gone to someone and say, I fell down, I hurt myself. Oh, everything will be okay. That platitude, right? But God's platitudes aren't like that. God has given us, like, his promises have backbone to it because he's been through it. He knows. And so he knows what perfect promise to give you that's going to give you the best comfort. So, in summary, where is God when it hurts? For those of you who have used your free will and said, I'm going to choose you, God, he's inside you. He's not inside the pain. He's the fourth person in the fiery furnace. He's right there beside you in whatever struggle that you're going through. For those who don't know God, guess what? He's right there. He wants to be there. Hey, I know. I can help you through this. Are we fully going to be answering the question of why? Why would a loving God allow and you fill in the blank? No, he didn't answer all of Job's questions. I get gummed up sometimes with all those questions. Somebody at work asked me those questions, and it's like, how do I answer them? You know what? It's sometimes okay to say, I don't know. God is a big God. I don't know why all those things. But we can stand beside those who are suffering and embrace them. Yancey says that if we respond to questions of suffering, not with arguments, but with love, perhaps those questions would not be asked with such troubled intensity. Pain is an indicator of things that are not right. This world is not right. This world is not our home. Hallelujah. This world is not our home. We were destined for better things where there is no pain. And we'll leave you with 2 Corinthians 4:16-18 again. Therefore, do not lose heart. He already said, I've overcome the world, right? Don't lose heart. Outwardly, we are wasting away, yet inwardly, we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes, not as what is seen, not around the here, why this pain? Since what we see here is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Whew.